This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind a Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
It's a special edition of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, episode 94. From our favorite watering hole in downtown Toronto, this is Sneaky D's, a place we've been frequenting since high school, a place we absolutely love. A little bit of a descriptor here. This place is open till 5 a.m., serving questionable Mexican fare, one could say, and the tables here are gouged with knife graffiti. It's a really interesting place if you're ever in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I would say it's a tourist attraction up there with the CN Tower. Actually, fuck the CN Tower. I'd come here instead. Yeah.
Well, this is my local watering hole. I mean, this place is right at the corner of College and Bathurst, for those that are local. I love it. I'm here at least once a week. And we figured, yeah, why not change things up a bit and get out and record in our favorite watering hole.
Yeah,
so here we are.
One of our favorite series and a really barking mad entry in it. Mm-hmm. That maybe sullied the entire enterprise. This is Death Wish 3.
I would say elevated it, but anyway.
Yeah.
We're talking about Death Wish 3.
3.
Yes, Death Wish 3 from 1985, starring Charles Bronson. Do I even need to say that? No, this is incredible. I mean, the original Death Wish was a Stone Cold classic. It was a vigilante film, and it was, I guess you could say, a product of its time. But it was a good movie, despite the fact that it was released to a lot of controversy,
yes,
espousing vigilanteism, etc., etc. That came out in 1974, and it was directed by Michael Winner. Years later, in 82, our favorite boys, the Cannon Boys, Golden Globus, decided to pick up the franchise. Reunited Winner and Bronson, and they brought out Death Wish 2 in 1982. An exploitative masterpiece. I mean, Death Wish 2 is
utterly ridiculous.
Utterly almost reprehensible. Yeah. The rape scenes are just completely awful.
And kind of lazy too, because what they did, the first one, I think we can assume that most people have seen the first one, and it's legendary for its depiction of how New York City has gone to seed. Mm-hmm. The second one, they decamped to Los Angeles,
right,
and then they explained it away, because the first end of the first one, he goes to Chicago to start a new business.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, they said, oh, he was in Chicago for a while and then came here. Like, it's totally...
Well,
like,
no, it was actually L.A. It was L.A.
Well, in L.A., but he went to Chicago at
right.
the end of the first
and
one. So
the
they explained it away by saying, in the second one in L.A., he was in Chicago for a while, which is like screenwriter 101, like the laziest thing you can possibly do to explain something that's completely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, he was there for a while, and now he's here.
Wow.
It's like he might as well have had like a kid like from a sitcom that they didn't explain either. It's like, here's little Johnny.
So in the third one, he's back in New York from L.A., and this one was done in 85. So once again, again, this is Bronson and Winter. This was the last Death Wish film that Winter directed. They made two other sequels after this one. And this one is just fucking batshit insane. I mean, again, this is the Cannon Boys. This is Cannon 80s success at its finest. Ironically, despite the fact that this one is back in New York, it really isn't.
No.
There's a few establishing shots at the beginning of Bronson.
He was taking the bus for some reason, because the guy, I'm not sure if they were, if he was actually a architect or just a land developer.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. In 1 and 2, he's an architect.
Mm.
In this one, all pretense is of him being an architect is gone. I mean, at one point he calls himself a retired writer. So he's no longer an architect, but he's back in the back in New York City.
Yeah, and he's taking a bus mm-hmm. to the Port Authority bus terminal, which is way beneath his station. This is something I would recommend anyone do if they're visiting New York City, because it's like incredibly sleazy. And this is a guy who presumably is a 1%er or a millionaire type. Like he had his own business. He was going to Texas to set up these developments, and mm-hmm. he's there in on a bus, like a shitty bus, like going into the like he can't get on a plane from LA in order to go back.
He's in a Cannon film, man. Yeah. They're going to cut corners anywhere they can. And speaking of cutting corners, they filmed this one in London,
mm-hmm.
despite the fact that you have a few establishing shots of the Big Apple at the beginning when he's taking that bus into the terminal, and a couple other establishing shots when he gets out and hails a cab. As soon as they cut to the main streets that he's going to have to clean up, it's London. London, London, London.
It looked...
And yeah, you could tell.
It was so good, like Potemkin Village. Like this was really, you know, these buildings looked so slipshod. The construction, it just looked like they were made in order to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. I had no idea that was London. I just figured... Because they did it semi-well at times, and I thought, oh, this could be part of the burned-out Bronx. Like, this could be the Bronx, but likely it isn't, because it looks very... The streetscapes don't make any sense, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, and again, this is another hallmark of Cannon. I mean, when they did Superman IV, the Quest for Peace, they substituted London for Metropolis, and, you know, it was, again, very unconvincingly.
And this, by way of introduction, lengthy one at that, is obviously a vigilante film, and it reminds me of this old joke, what's a conservative? It's a liberal who's been mugged, and it's essentially like a guy who's been the victim of crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's just... I thought if they... Because I tried to watch 4 and I couldn't just because I got so tired of this thing. But mm-hmm. the premise of these is basically... The first one, his wife and daughter get attacked. They're left for dead. The wife dies. He takes it upon himself to become this sort of Batman
mm-hmm.
to go clean the streets of riffraff.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, more members of his immediate family that start getting... what was it? A housekeeper and his daughter or whatever else.
She got brutally raped and the daughter got killed.
Now the third one is his friend, again, mm-hmm. heretofore unmentioned best friend who we never were introduced to in any other aspect of the series.
This is old buddy Charlie.
War buddy who gets, I guess, murdered in his quote-unquote, you know, East New York, Brooklyn...
Tenement slum.
Tenement.
I believe on the corner of Sutter and Belmont.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
they established this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And this is a fucking war zone, this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not, you know, your typical New York City slum. I mean, this is, it's a war zone. It's like Fallujah with a cast of Electric Boogaloo, you know, terrorizing the area. I mean, that's, you know, like I said before, it's totally extreme. I mean, all the punks, they're all just completely like straight up Marvel Comics. I mean, they're stereotypical. We'll get to them a bit later. But I mean, this movie... It's just nuts. I mean, the body count in this one is a whopping 83.
Holy crap.
It's huge.
Like Saving Private Ryan.
Totally, man. I mean, it's insane. And, I mean, any sense of propriety that you might have had in the first or second, although there was very little propriety, really, is thrown out the window for this one, and it goes right for the exploitation. This one is all about just big explosions, high body count, and pure entertainment value. So Kersey... is back in the big city and his reputation. I want to say this before I go on. This is the first Death Wish film that was filmed after the Bernard Goetz incident.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I guess for listeners in the UK, if they're not familiar with it, Bernard Goetz, I think he's probably close to 70 now. He's a resident of Queens, New York, and he was infamously on a subway. And when he was confronted by 4 thugs, and he had an illegal weapon on him, and he proceeded to blow 4 of these guys away, killing one of them and seriously injuring 3.
Mm-hmm.
And he was turned into a folk hero.
He was hailed as a hero, yeah.
Yeah, and his name...
For taking the law into his own hands.
Yeah.
Because in the 80s, I mean, the Big Apple is pretty much rotten to its core. Mm-hmm. The fact that somebody actually took it upon himself to blow. And I'm sure he was somewhat inspired by Paul Kersey and Death Wish. So mm-hmm. it's interesting that...
And that's what's interesting, too, about Death Wish is, as the series progresses, it becomes more and more ludicrous to accept the premise that someone... should take the law into their own hands. Mm-hmm. The first one, you go, oh, the guy's wife has been raped and murdered. Like,
there's more ambiguity in the first one.
Yeah, and yeah. the guy's like, oh, I gotta do something about it, but he's not sure because he's a family man who works as an architect. It's kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not a gunslinger. But in the third one, the one we're talking about here, he's relishing his role as judge, jury, and executioner.
Well, not only that,
absurd.
But he's doing it under the auspices of the police chief.
Yeah,
basically, he says, you know, you're my man, you're going to clean up the neighborhood. So let's get into this. So, okay,
Yeah, and when people say the first one is fascistic, I would disagree, it's morally ambiguous. This one is fascistic. Like, you're, okay, your friend gets blown away. You're known by the cops to be this vigilante figure.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of keeping tabs on him and just saying, like, you know, we should really arrest this guy because you don't want people roaming the streets doing this. They are complicit in helping the guy go about his, what is essentially murder.
But, to be fair, I mean, they did arrest him originally. Because, so, you know, Kersey takes the bus into the Big Apple, presumably from Los Angeles. And he, the first thing he wants to do is visit old buddy Charlie. And before Kersey gets there, Charlie is party to a few unwelcome visitors, these aforementioned thugs. And, I mean, these thugs just own the neighborhood. It should be mentioned that one of the thugs is played by pre-Bill and Ted Alex Winter.
Mm-hmm.
And another thug, although he doesn't really have much in the way of lines, is played by Bobby Wilde, who female Cenobite in mm-hmm. Hellraiser 2, who we had the pleasure of meeting when mm-hmm. we were at the very first Horrorama. But anyhow... before Kersey gets there, these thugs come in and they're demanding money, protection money from Charlie, and he refuses to give it. So they beat him ostensibly to death. When Kersey gets there, he's just expired, he's about to expire. The cops burst in and they blame Kersey. Mm-hmm. Kersey is arrested. And the police chief, he knows who he's got. He's like, whoa, okay, you know, I haven't heard of you for a number of years, but it looks like you're back. Well, you know what, Kersey? And Kersey at this point was going by the name of Kimball. He goes...
it's like Richard Kimball from the Harrison Ford movie, The Fugitive.
Yes, indeed. And the TV show that inspired mm-hmm. that movie. He goes, Kersey, this is my jail and I'm the law. No bail for you. And I'm thinking, like, since when is that a police chief's decision?
Well, he was also trying to strong-arm the public defender. Mm-hmm. Saying, you know, we tried to get him out, to try to spring him. He says, no, he's staying in here. Like, he's judge, jury, and executioner. He's above the law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. And so Kersey's in the cell, and he's got a cellmate. This really tall, imposing... Here, yeah, fill me up, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a pitcher of beer here. Just this really tall, imposing ginger guy with a reverse mohawk.
Yes.
Whose name is Fraker.
Yeah.
And him...
stripe painted down the middle, okay?
Well, and him and Kersey don't
see eye to eye, you know, literally and figuratively.
Fraker is giving
a giant guy.
Yeah, Fraker is giving Kersey the old stink eye, mm-hmm. and before you know, they're engaging in fisticuffs. And for an old cacker, because I got to say that Charles Bronson, when he filmed this movie, he was 64 years old. For an old cacker, he holds his own in this.
I was going to say it's sort of beggared belief at this point. After the first one, he's sort of, you could see him as a sort of a suave, which I. War vet, like tough guy, which he was, the real Charles Bronson, the World War II vet. By the time you get to the 80s here, he was looking a little long in the tooth.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
Graying mane and just, to take on this 6'4", just badass, I don't know. But
yeah,
he's still in awesome shape, or was in awesome shape.
Yeah, so this Fraker is released and goes back to Sutter and Belmont. He's really the leader of the gang.
Yeah.
He's the one
terrorizing East New York.
Mm-hmm. The police chief, whose name is Schreiker, he realizes that it's Sutter and Belmont, they need to clean up this neighborhood, but they can't do it because, you know, they're cops. I mean, they're bound by certain rules, procedures, and so on. But Kersey, being the vigilante he is, with a reputation, precedes himself. Hey man, he can go in there and he can do the things that cops can't do. So Stryker releases Kersey and gives him carte blanche to go to work. He does say, you have to report to me, and, you know, but you go there and you clean up the neighborhood, which is patently ridiculous, but hey, you know what? Whatever gets the plot going.
Yeah, especially since they were so hell-bent on finally putting him away. And considering that has just been gone, put aside completely, instead of they have him in their custody, instead of sending him to the big house for 20 years. Like, this guy, it clearly has been his mission to get this guy. They instead get him to work for the feds, or get him to work for them. Like, it's an absurd conceit, like one of the many, many in this film.
Absurd, yet awesome.
Yeah.
So, now we have Paul Kersey back on the streets, and he's a man with a mission. He's going to clean up the... Well, of course, I mean, there's a personal element to it, and the fact that this gang kills his friend Charlie. So he goes to the apartment, and he meets the denizens of this...
This slum tenement.
And, I mean, it's an interesting bunch of residents. Yeah. I mean, they're all good people. Predominantly, I would say... aged, you know, yes. What I mean? You have the Kaprobs. This is the Jewish couple.
Russian-Jewish couple, yeah.
You have the Bennett, who was a good friend with Charlie. He's played by Martin Balsam. Mm-hmm. And Martin Balsam, I mean, he's a great actor. I mean, this guy was in movies like 12 Angry Men. He was in the original Psycho, Breakfast at Tiffany's. He was also in one of our favorite movies, the original Take Me Up Pelham 1-2-3.
Yeah, awesome.
And in this movie, he was basically a World War II veteran. And him and Kersey become fast friends. He says, hey, look, Charlie's apartment, the rent is paid off for a month. Why don't you sell yourself in there and help us out? Because really, I mean, every night... These poor denizens of this...
Yeah, they're under siege.
They're under siege. I mean, every night, there's rockets on the window, people coming in, demanding protection. Nobody can walk... You have a Latino couple. Nobody can walk the streets without being harassed.
I think the Latino couple was inserted there to temper some of the more, I would say, ugly possible racial issues they might have had. And the same reason, I think, they diluted the vision of the author of The Warriors. Conception of that film by making all the gang members like a rainbow of multi-ethnicity, so they wouldn't, you know, offend as many people. And also his friends have to be shown to be all different people of color and whatnot, because, you know, again, the politics of this thing, a little bit ugly.
but this gang, I mean, they were a rainbow collection.
Yes.
I mean, you had, you know, it was whites, blacks, Latinos, Cubans, what have you. Cubans, that's not a race, but anyway. But yeah, I mean, the one thing that distinguished them as gang members is they all had this, as you mentioned earlier, this red stripe painted down their forehead.
Yeah, like they're some sort of Hindu penitents or something.
With two horizontal black stripes.
Yeah.
Crisscrossing it. And their leader, as I mentioned before, is this guy, Fraker. Anyway... Kersey is selling into the neighborhood, and I mentioned before he makes fast friends with everybody in the building. He smells something. What's that smell? Oh, it's so tantalizing.
Cabbage rolls and coffee?
Yes, cooked by the Kaprobs.
Good. Yeah.
And he's invited, well, he basically invites himself for dinner, but they're happy to, extend some hospitality. And as they're sitting down and enjoying this lovely dinner, rocks fly in the window.
It's so stupid. It's so ridiculous. Yeah.
It should be mentioned what he did. Because he actually bought a Cadillac and he parked it in a very conspicuous place beforehand to use as bait.
Yes.
So.
Which is stupid as well, because they completely total this vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, and ratcheting up the stupidity as well. Like, he's sitting down ostensibly to dinner with these neighbors, and then he excuses himself, goes out and just blows to Kingdom Come the people who were destroying his vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you'll permit me, I gotta, you know, visit the little boy's room. No, he goes outside and wastes these guys. Like, and I don't recall whether they were watching him from the window or whatever, but, you know, he just in point blank in the middle of the streets, as if, no, with no throwing caution to the wind, like no, at least in the first one, it was under cover of darkness. It was in the underground garages, in alleyways. This was just right out in the open in front of everyone.
Yes, but what's the reaction of the neighborhood denizens? A thunderous round of applause. They love it. They love it. There is a man who's going to get results, who's going to clean up the streets. Mm. The other thing that's interesting in this one too is that Kersey's got a bit of Macaulay Culkin in him. Little Home Alone. He's a master booby trapper all of a sudden.
Yes, I guess teaching this aged octogenarian Russian couple how to, or I guess he installs.
He installs a giant
very
mouse
illegal,
trap.
Very
a giant mouse trap.
Sinister piece of what? 2x4 on a spring that
with
has nails, in it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, these...
It's triggered by someone who tries to open a window.
Are continually trying to enter these apartments and, you know...
But it's so wrong, like, morally.
Dude, it's so right.
Yeah.
I mean, what is... Do you think that these poor apartment denizens need to be terrorized every single
sure
night
enough.
By...
Well, that's more... It's a question that, straddles the line between what constitutes self-defense and what constitutes... Jeez. Like, something is torturous, because later on in the film, when one of the intruders springs this 2x4 nail pulley levered contraption, it takes out two of his fucking teeth that are embedded in this thing, which is just gross, like, and weird. Like, he's tripwired this elderly couple's home to be like a weapon.
He also places.
But they also have their own weapon. Like, the old guy has his own gun.
Yeah. Well, everybody has. At which, you know, the police at one point confiscate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another thing too, is the fact that they have something to protect themselves.
Yes.
The police are trying to confiscate their weapons, but they aren't doing shit about the gangs.
Yes.
What's the message there?
I don't know. Lots of conflicting messages.
So, we should talk a bit about this attorney. She's fascinated by Paul Kersey.
That this of all the things, in a movie with shoot-em-ups that claim the lives of 100 gang members, the stupidest thing in this film is the romantic relationship between the public defender...
Who's half his age.
Yes.
Literally half his age.
And looks it. Like, she really looks like his daughter. It is so absurd. And she just she hails a cab to Brooklyn and to look for him, not knowing his address. Because earlier in the film, she, I guess, finally does get him from jail, but asks him for, I guess, an address so she can follow up, or a phone number, a contact info, so they can sue the NYPD. He has no interest in it. He just walks away. So she ostensibly does not know where he lives, but she has a rough idea. She gets in a cab and goes to look for him in the middle of this, like, godforsaken war zone.
And she finds him.
He's so wonderful, like this graying, pompadour 60-year-old Bronson, that he can still attract the interest
of a mustache. It's all about the stash, okay? And she makes her way there, and she invites him for dinner at her place.
Yeah, first date. Good on him.
Which is, and it's funny, because when they are having that date, and she says to Bronson, "I don't know anything about you." Of course you don't. You haven't said two words to this guy. when you sprung him from prison, he basically sprung himself.
Yeah.
He was a strong, solid type. You don't know anything about the guy. Okay, they're having dinner. And it's funny because, she's an attorney. She's ostensibly supposed to be on the side of those that are accused.
Mm.
But as they're having their date, she goes, "Oh, the city. I don't know. I feel like I'm on the wrong side. Damn it. People have to fight back."
Yeah.
And hard, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie. Now, there's got to be escalation, and damn, is there ever escalation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, this gang, okay, here you have Kersey blowing away a number of their...
Henchmen.
Number of their
goons.
Yeah, and not only the ones that he isn't blowing away, he's maiming with these ridiculous booby traps. So, it's always got to become personal. If it wasn't personal enough, they killed Charlie, they killed this attorney.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he's waiting in the car, I believe... Bronson went to get ice cream or something, or is my chronology a bit?
I believe so. Yeah. And she's waiting in the car, and they break the glass and punch her in the face and knock her unconscious, and then
release
the
brake.
Gear. Yeah. And put it into drive and send the thing down a hill.
Yeah, and it crashed into a tree, and she's expired. They also rape the wife of the Latino couple, and he expires.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be just a broken arm. He goes with the husband to the hospital, and she's no longer with us. Well, I thought it was just a broken arm. Yeah, but there's a few blood clots, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how a broken arm could result in a fatal death. But I mean, this is war. I mean, now, there's another stereotypical tough. His name is the Giggler. We gotta talk about the Giggler. Again, I mean, he looks like one of the cast members of Electric Boogaloo. He looks like one of the dancers. But I mean, his claim to fame is he's really fast.
Mm-hmm.
He can run super fast. Bronson can't catch him.
Yeah, his MO is, I guess, he just carries a little switchblade on him, and he cuts women's purses loose and just hightails it down the mean streets and is incapable of being caught and tracked down. So yeah, the giggler, that's his thing.
Now, the whole time Bronson is saying to the residents, he goes, "Don't worry, my friend Willie is coming." And when Willie arrives, what is Willie? It's a motherfucking huge gun. It's a 457 Magnum. 44 Magnum, Dirty Harry, be damned. This thing is fucking massive. So he finally gets the giggler because the giggler snatches this old lady's purse as he's running away. Bronson blows him away in the back. And this is when the neighborhood applauds at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. And it also should be said that this, whoever makes this gun, what is it, Wiley? Okay.
Well, he
said, actually
Willie
sponsored this film. They're one of
really?
The. Yeah, oh, and wow. In the closing credits, I saw this. And yeah, again, this is kind of the ugly politics of this thing. Whereas in the first one, this is just an ordinary, average guy you can relate to. In this one, he's taking great glee in wasting people and also in describing his weaponry. So they have this. In the first one, I guess the guy's taken to a shooting range. And Kersey says, "I don't like guns. I'm a New Yorker. I don't have anything to do with it." And then he's shown how to shoot by this Texan businessman. In this one, he's just... This guy's like might as well be a member of the NRA. Like, he's just lauding the benefits of this wonderful gun, and there's three separate scenes where they're talking about the shells and this is a 257 and this will do this and this is the speed of the thing when it leaves the barrel. Like all this ridiculous, like just basically kneeling at the altar of gun culture, and that's something way removed from the first one. And I thought that was just wild.
So you're right, it is glorifying gun culture,
really
now.
Glorifying
amazing. The other amazing thing is that the deceased Charlie, one of his last words to Kersey was, you know, "Take care of my stuff." What is his stuff? A fucking armory.
Yes,
the guy's got like a missile launcher, the guy's got submachine gun, everything. So
and it still works because it's from World War II, and I guess the guy's been polishing it or whatever, keeping it in good condition, and he's got this giant bandolier, and again when Kersey takes it upon himself to use this weaponry, he conscripts the Latino neighbor to hold this box full of his bandoliers, which is ludicrous. He's got this guy like running alongside him holding the bullets while he wastes all these guys.
Yeah.
This thing was so ridiculous.
And before that, Martin Balsam's character, Bennett, attempts to take down, because he has an auto shop, and I think they blew it up. It was a clock. He was a clock repairman.
Yeah.
And he attempts to go out with a submachine gun, but he's
he's quickly disarmed.
He's
put
into the hospital, But, this is okay. Now it's coming down to this is going to be a climactic battle for the ages. And Fraker, witnessing all of his henchmen being disposed of by this septuagenarian, calls in for reinforcements. And I don't know how many
bikers from neighboring boroughs where it's
stereotypical goons, just decide to come in and say, "Yeah, sure, why not?" It comes down to basically Kersey versus a cast of thousands. And it's not just Kersey, because Stryker, the captain, actually
he joins in,
fights alongside him. And it's fucking insane. I mean, at this point, everything is going to hell. You have businesses being blown up, you have people being set on fire, you have the neighborhood fighting back, it's just unbelievable.
People falling from fire escapes.
Lots of people falling out of windows. Yeah. And falling forward when they're being shot. One of the cliches that
one of our favorites.
Slash hate. Grenades. Just, like I said, explosions.
Yeah, he does have a grenade launcher, too. It really is like Fallujah.
Yeah, this is Canxs at its finest. Mm. This is, like I say, the last 20, 30 minutes of the film is just complete carnage. And this is insanity. As you said before, it's ludicrous when you have Kersey running around with this submachine gun with this Latino behind him
holding the bullets.
Yeah, it's hilarious. You gotta also say, before he does it, he has a weapon of his own, some sort of like pump gun.
I don't know what the hell that was, but yeah. And again, more people have been, I guess, set up with the triggered board that I guess other residents have been set up to booby trap their own apartments, so that comes into play as well.
How do you like the Steely Dan that we got?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, okay. I mean, sorry.
You don't lose that number.
Continue.
and in the middle of this war zone, you'd think NYPD would be descending en masse to this street shootout, like straight out of, you know, the Dakotas and the Wild Wild West and Billy the Kid. It takes them forever to finally send like four pathetic squad cars out there.
Yeah, and they're pretty useless.
Yeah.
But like I said, you have Kersey and the cop, the police chief, basically at this point out running down the streets trying to mow down these tops. At the end of it all, in yet another ludicrous scene, in a movie filled with ludicrous scenes, Kersey blows away Fraker with a missile launcher.
Yeah.
How much better can you get? How much more excessive can you get in a canon film? How much further removed can you get from the original movie?
Yeah. And that's what I was thinking too, because they basically did the opposite of everything that made the first one good.
Mm.
They, instead of having characters who are close loved ones of the protagonist getting off to something with which all of us can relate, a loved one, we would, if our girlfriends were in such a, you know, we would act the same way.
That,
but it makes you wonder, like, if this thing got to part 6 and 7,
after Ross would have been 90, but anyway.
True, but who would have been killed? Like the guy who gives him coffee in the morning? Would he avenge his death? Like maybe his local
newspaper,
baker?
But it's interesting.
The cable man? Like who is next to avenge?
It's interesting you bring that up because in the first one, it sort of asks the audience that question, what would you do? You know?
And we all would say we would do that.
And it created a bit of a dialogue. Some people said, you know what, I agree with Kersey's action. I would have done the exact same thing. I've taken the law in my own hands. Other people said, no, that's not right. It's the same with the Bernie Gestrel. You know, some people held him as a hero. Some people said, no, you know, you can't take the law in your own hands. Leave it to the police.
And that's this one makes it just so much worse.
It just glorifies carnage.
Yeah, because these people are not murderers. They're just drug dealers. A lot of these henchmen.
No, they're murderers.
Some of them are, but you can't tell me that of all the 100 bodies that were laid waste to, all these guys were murderers. Like, the body count is through the roof.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys are just hangers-on and just associates of these gangs. Like, not all murderers.
I think that Fricker's gang, I mean, the way they were terrorizing these poor elderly Dennisons, and of course, by having elderly people being victimized, that's obviously it's going to bring up some sympathy.
Yeah.
They deserve to be
wasted. The core of the gang deserve to be wasted.
And then just having the people who came in for reinforcements, I mean, they were just cannon fodder. They were just body count. You know, this is a body count movie.
Yeah.
And it was just basically an 80s excess action movie. Let's just kill as many people as we can. Let's blow up as many buildings as we can.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have as much gratuitousness as we can. And for that, I say it worked.
Yeah.
I personally have, I hold this movie in high esteem. I think it's completely ludicrous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not art in the least bit.
No.
There's no subtext. There's no smarts. There's nothing to it. It's just complete exploitation.
Yeah.
But man, is it fun.
It's hilarious.
I love it.
I will unabashedly watch every Death Wish, and I don't care. Yeah. Hilarious. It's completely off the charts. Ridiculous.
What did you learn from Death Wish 3?
Well, considering we're just about to order our lunch here at Sneaky D's, I learned that chicken's good. I like chicken.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of the rip-roaring, cracking
dialogue.
Oh,
yes, that was a nice little line. Yeah, when they had their date.
when the public defender offers to make Kersey dinner at her place. Chicken. I like chicken. I'm like, man, this is so lazy. Like, they really just took everything that made the first one great and excised it and churned out this thing. I also learned that despite being a septuagenarian, graying, mustachioed, long in the tooth
architect.
He has enough upper body strength that when he was being held in the, you know, in the jail, he rams one of the goons' heads right through the bars, and everyone else applauds. Like in the gang, before he takes on the major tough, and they're separated. Man, this guy can put a man's head through bars.
I learned that yet again, canon
They never let me down, man. I mean, it's all about the excess.
It's all about the excess.
It's all about the commercial elements, the exploitation.
Explaining and, away things that just make absolutely no
you,
sense.
Yeah, you take something that, you know, has some merit, whether it's artistic merits, subtext, what have you, you give it to the Cannon Boys, and they're
they will.
And as you said before, when we're talking about Cobra, there's always things in Cannon movies that are just a little bit off, a little bit wrong. And in this movie, again, it's rife with that. The sexual assault of the Latino lady. I mean, it was just, why? It was just so, like, why did they do that? What was the point? You know, there was enough reason for Bronson to go out there and clean up the streets,
for sure.
You know? But yet they had to throw that in. Maybe they figured, okay, well, I don't know. We had a, we had a rape in the second one. It was successful. Let's do it again. But Cannon, you know, love him or hate him, I personally love him. When you see the Cannon logo at the beginning of a movie, I love
just,
seeing
it
that
just,
logo.
It makes you feel warm inside.
You know you're in for a good time. And I mean, this movie is, again, it's indicative of everything that made Cannon great. It's 80s excess at its finest. It's dumb as fuck, but I mean, man, oh man, is it entertaining. I'm gonna give this one, on my Cannon scale, I would give it 4 stars. On an objective rating scale,
an objective rating scale I'll of give a legit it, movie, I give it maybe 2.5 to 3.
Yeah, I give it about 3 stars.
Yeah, if the first one didn't exist, the first Death Wish, which is a classic, then I would be a lot more sympathetic and a lot more lenient in my ranking of this thing. Yeah, I'm going to give it probably a 3 myself here, but no, maybe I will power through the, whatever remaining death wishes I have to go through.
Well, yeah, I mean, they get really, really bad after this one, 4 and 5. I mean, at this point, you got Bronson pushing 70, and it's just like getting really, really, really sad, actually. So I would say this is probably the peak of the series.
Yeah.
I mean, you get one, for different reasons, you know, one is worth watching, 2 is worth watching, 3 is worth watching. I'm not so much 4 and 5.
Yeah.
But that's my own opinion. I love Bronson. I love him in lots of other stuff he's done. The Mechanic. Even in Once Upon a Time in the West.
In the West,
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
He was even in Vincent Price's House of Wax.
Hmm.
You know, good old Charles, I forget his name. Is it Bukowski or something?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. But Polish, you know, the Polish, the Lithuanian.
Yeah, Lithuanian. And yeah, just unmistakable, just legendary figure. And
yeah.
This is really what made him and what everyone associates him with.
Yeah, I love Chucky. And the thing about Bronson, too, is there's always a mystique. He was never one that to do a lot of interviews, nor did he really talk much when he was on screen. He was a very much a strong, silent guy, minimal dialogue. Bronson is an amazing figure. I prefer him much more than Chuck Norris. I'm not a big Norris fan myself.
Yeah, no, Norris, in terms of, you know, the bona fides that he brings as a martial artist, brilliant. But as an actor, yeah, he's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So, you know. But again, he is on our Mount Chuckmore, a silly meme I created for our site of the various Chucks that we like, you know, Charlton Heston and whatnot. I'd love to hear what your favorite Rape Revenge or Vigilante shoot-em-up films are. There's a lot of them. A lot of them are highly controversial. We'd love to know your favorites, so send us an email, reallyawfulmovies.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.